Well, welcome to the Epic Podcast, a chronological journey through the Old Testament. This is where you get to navigate the whole story and begin to understand the thread and meaning of the entire biblical blueprint with Michelle Neertling. This is episode 31. Today we're going to cover the book of Daniel, Ezra 1-4, and some of Haggai and Zechariah. Last week marked the beginning of the end for Judah, but also the beginning of glory. It was the moment when everything seemed lost, and yet heaven whispered that the story was far from over. Yes, God's presence had left Solomon's temple. Ezekiel saw it lift and move, but it had not vanished. It had gone with his people. The glory of God no longer hovered above Jerusalem, but above the exiles in Babylon. Only when Jerusalem finally fell did the exiles truly grasp the depth of their loss. And yet, when Ezekiel spoke again, his words carried a strange, radiant hope. He saw a valley filled with dry bones, lifeless, scattered, forgotten. But at the word of the Lord, breath entered them, and they stood on their feet, a vast army reborn. "I will put my spirit in you, and you will live," the Lord said, "and I will settle you in your own land." The exile was both judgment and renewal. Through fire, God was purifying his people. Through loss, he was preserving his promise. And through a prophet in captivity, he was painting the future, a vision of resurrection. Ezekiel saw beyond the rubble, beyond exile, beyond judgment, to the day God would breathe life again into his people. The fall of Jerusalem was not the end. It was the beginning of redemption's next chapter. God had not forsaken his people. He was rebuilding them from the ground up. The covenant still stood. The story was still being written. And in Babylon, a new story was already rising. Last week we witnessed three waves of exile, and in the first we met Daniel, taken to Babylon to serve King Nebuchadnezzar in the palace. Daniel remained pure despite his world changing around him. He gave his captor his best, but his heart belonged to God, even if it cost him. God blessed him with wisdom, insight, and the divine ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Previously, in Daniel chapter 2, we encountered Nebuchadnezzar's dream of a statue, gold, silver, bronze, iron, and clay. God unveiled a glimpse of his sovereign plan, not merely a vision of earthly kingdoms, but a prophetic sequence pointing towards the rise of a kingdom that cannot be shaken. But before we continue today's story, let us pause for a moment. From the time of captivity, we witness a shift in prophetic revelation. The visions given to Daniel transcend Israel's immediate future and speak to the destiny of nations and the unfolding of God's eternal purposes. Daniel saw far into the future, into our time and beyond. In the New Testament, only John, through the revelation given on Patmos, received a comparable unveiling of divine mysteries. So let's pick up our epic story in Daniel 7. Folks, the chapters in Daniel jump back and forth and do not read chronologically. We are going to follow the timeline, and I will lead you to the correct chapters to grasp the thread of the epic. In Daniel chapter 7, it's been almost 50 years since Jerusalem fell, and Daniel, now an older man, has spent most of his life in Babylon. The people have built homes, raised children, and sought the peace of the city that enslaved them. God had instructed them, through Jeremiah, to make peace with their captivity until the 70 years were over. Daniel has lived two generations of Babylonian kings, and at this point in the story, Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, has become the third king of Babylon during Daniel's captivity. During the first year of Belshazzar's reign, Daniel had a dream, not for the king but for himself, and then he wrote down the substance of the dream. It seemed to carry a similar message as the one Nebuchadnezzar had 50-odd years back. Daniel saw the four winds of heaven stirring the great sea, and from it four beasts rose, a lion with eagle's wings, a bear raised on one side, a leopard with four heads, and then a beast unlike any before it, iron-toothed, terrible, ruthless. And from among its horns rises one, small at first, but speaking great and boastful words, a power that magnifies itself, that exalts its own will above heavens. Folks, he was seeing the future kingdoms, but while Daniel understood that these beasts represented kingdoms, he likely did not know their specific names or historical details. The clarity we have today comes from looking backward through the lens of fulfilled prophecy and recorded history. Today we know the lion was Babylon, the bear Persia, the leopard Greece, and the iron-toothed beast Rome. Then Daniel's vision shifted. Thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. Fire flowed from his throne, the court was convened, and the books were opened. And Daniel saw one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Daniel's vision, however, did trouble his spirit, and he asked the man in the vision to explain. The man told him, "The four beasts he saw, each one fierce and distinct, represent four kingdoms that would rise from the earth." But the vision doesn't end in fear or confusion. It crescendoed with hope. Daniel is told that in the end, the Most High will give his everlasting kingdom to the saints. That's the unshakable truth. No matter how terrifying the empires of man may seem, the Ancient of Days will judge, and the dominion will be handed over to the Holy Ones. This is the promise. God's kingdom will not pass away. Then in Daniel chapter 8, not long after his earlier visions, in the third year of King Belshazzar, Daniel received another revelation, one that would look far beyond Babylon's fall. In this vision, Daniel found himself beside the Ulai Canal in the fortress city of Susa. He looked up and he saw a ram standing before the water. It had two horns, one higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. The ram charged west, north, and south. Nothing could stand against it. Then suddenly, from the west, a goat came rushing across the earth so swiftly that its feet did not touch the ground. Between its eyes was a notable horn. The goat struck the ram with furious power, broke its horns, and trampled it down. As Daniel watched, that great horn was broken, and in its place came up four notable horns, reaching toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them rose a little horn, arrogant and blasphemous. It grew exceedingly great, even reaching to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the stars, trampled the sanctuary, and opposed the Prince of Princes himself. This was no ordinary vision. It pointed to future empires, kingdoms not yet risen in Daniel's day. And as Daniel sought to understand it, Gabriel, the one who stands in God's presence, the messenger of heaven, appeared before him. This was the first time in Scripture his name was mentioned. Gabriel said, "Understand, Son of Man, for the vision concerns the time of the end." He explained that the ram with two horns represents the Medes and Persians, and the goat symbolized the king of Greece, its great horn being the first mighty king, Alexander the Great. After his fall, four kingdoms would rise from his empire, but not with his power. And from one of them, a fierce and cunning ruler would emerge, a shadow of what would come in the latter days. This little horn foreshadowed not only Antiochus Epiphanes, who would later desecrate the temple, but also pointed towards a future rebellion against God himself. As Daniel listened, he fainted and was sick for days, overwhelmed by what he had seen. History, it seemed, would move from empire to empire, but heaven had already written every chapter. Through Gabriel, God revealed that history is not chaos, it's choreographed. Every empire, every exile, and every restoration is part of a single story, the epic story, the story of a kingdom that will never be shaken. Not long after those visions, Babylon's glory began to fade, and we continue our story in Daniel chapter 5. It has been 70 years since Judah was exiled and kept captive in Babylon. And like so many rich kids, King Belshazzar of Babylon had no idea how to steward the wealth he had inherited. Nor had he matured in wisdom and learned to respect the God who had made it all possible. He loved to party, and one night he was out to impress his nobles. Wine flowed like rivers. Music filled the palace. Golden lamps flickered against marble walls. And in a moment of arrogance, Belshazzar ordered that the sacred vessels, the very cups taken from the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, be brought out and filled with wine. They lifted the holy cups of God's house, and they drank to the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. They were making a mockery of the Almighty, and heaven reacted. In the midst of their laughter, a hand, just a hand, appeared and began to write on the plaster of the wall. Three words, Mene, Tekel, Parson. In a split second, the atmosphere sobered, a chill down every spine. No one could read the words. What did they mean? Daniel was summoned, and he gave the verdict. You have lifted yourself against the Lord of heaven. You drank from the vessels of his house. You praised idols that neither see, nor hear, nor understand. But the God who holds your life in his hands, you have not honored. Then Daniel read the words on the wall. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Parson, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. That night, the river gates of Babylon were breached. The army of Cyrus entered the city without resistance, and Belshazzar, the last king of Babylon, was slain. The head of gold had fallen, and just as Daniel had prophesied decades earlier, the chest and arms of silver, the empire of the Medes and the Persians, now took its place. Persia is now the global kingdom and in charge, and we continue the story of Daniel in chapter 6. This new empire of Persia was a dual monarchy, two nations united under one rule. Darius the Mede governed the region of Babylon, where Daniel lived, while Cyrus the Persian ruled the broader empire from his capital in Persia, likely north modern-day Iran. Rather than two rival kings, Darius and Cyrus were leaders within the same imperial structure. Cyrus held ultimate authority as emperor, and Darius was appointed to oversee Babylon. This explains why Daniel served under both names and reveals how God's plan was unfolding through both men. Now Darius, the new Persian king in Babylon, assigned 120 satraps, which included Daniel, to govern the land. He soon noticed Daniel's wisdom and integrity and planned to place him in charge of the kingdom's highest affairs. But the leaders quickly grew jealous and tried to discredit him. But Daniel never did anything wrong and excelled in everything he did. So they plotted against him. They knew Daniel would never compromise his faith, and they would use it against him to set a trap. They convinced the king to pass a decree that for 30 days no one could pray to any god or man except the king himself. Daniel knew the decree, but he also knew his God. As he had done all his life, he opened his window towards Jerusalem and he prayed. He was accused, condemned, and thrown into a den of lions, but heaven had already written the outcome. The God who shut the mouths of the furnace now shut the mouths of the lions, and when morning came, Daniel was found alive, untouched. Relieved, Darius himself proclaimed, "For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed." That same year, the first year of Darius the Mede, something incredible was unfolding in the spiritual realm. God was setting up the circumstances, and he was paving the way for a miracle. He was about to set the remnant free, to send them home, to return to Jerusalem and rebuild his dwelling place. And we have learned in these episodes, nothing is coincidental. Around that time, Daniel had been studying the scrolls of Jeremiah. We find the story in Daniel chapter 9. Daniel realized that the 70 years of desolation were nearly complete, but he also saw something deeper. He felt the weight of what those years truly meant. Not just exile, but heartbreak. The Lord had been rejected by his own people, and Daniel sensed the sorrow in God's heart, the pain of leading them into captivity. So Daniel didn't respond with celebration. He responded with a contrite spirit and a repentant heart. The desolation wasn't just a punishment. It was the echo of a broken relationship between God and his people. So he turned to God. He pleaded with him in prayer and petition, in fasting and in sackcloth and ashes. He confessed the sins of his people, not blaming them, but with brokenness. He acknowledged the justice of God's judgment and pleaded for mercy and restoration, for the covenant to be remembered. Lord, in keeping with all your righteous acts, turn away your anger and your wrath from Jerusalem. We do not make requests of you because we are righteous, but because of your great mercy. Then Gabriel, the same messenger from the earlier vision, appeared again and tenderly said, Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you began to pray, a word went out, which I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. And he revealed one of the most profound prophecies in all Scripture, a timeline of 77s, marking the coming of the Anointed One, the Messiah, who would bring atonement for sin, establishing everlasting righteousness, and fulfill every covenant promise. After Gabriel's words faded, silence filled the room. Daniel remained on his knees, trembling. It wasn't fear that held him there. It was awe. He had seen too much. He had heard heaven speak of things that reached far beyond his own life. The kingdoms of men, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, all of them would rise and fall. But above them, unseen, a greater kingdom was already at work. Daniel realized something profound that night. The exile had never been about punishment alone. It had been about preparation. God was not finished with his people. He was refining them. And through their story, he was preparing the world for the arrival of the Messiah. As Daniel sat in the quiet after Gabriel's visit, he must have remembered the words of Jeremiah, I know the plans I have for you. Yes, even in exile, even when everything seemed lost, because heaven's plans never end in despair, they end in redemption. Through Daniel, heaven had unveiled the full arc of redemption from Babylon's fall to the coming of Christ. Empires would pass, but God's plan would endure. The exile was ending. As Daniel's visions drew to a close, the words of the prophets began to converge. What Jeremiah had spoken, what Ezekiel had seen, and what Daniel had now discerned all pointed to the same horizon. The 70 years of exile were complete. The days of Babylon were over and Persia now ruled the world. Daniel's prayer for his people did not go unheard. The timing of Daniel's prayer aligned strikingly with Cyrus's decree. Could it be that Daniel's intercession helped stir the spirit of Cyrus? That his cry for mercy helped unlock the fulfillment of Isaiah's ancient prophecy and shift the principalities in heaven? We pick up the story in Ezra chapter 1. We are still in the first year of the Persian takeover, the first year of Cyrus, who is reigning in the Persian capital while Darius is reigning in Babylon. Let us imagine the scene. Cyrus has just defeated Babylon and now owns his captives, including the exiles of Judah. But instead of lording it over them, his heart is stirred to release the people and send them back to Jerusalem to rebuild their city and their temple. Was he just being kind? No, God was in control. More than a century before Cyrus was even born, God called him out by name through the prophet Isaiah, saying in Isaiah 44:28, I am the Lord who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he shall perform all my pleasure. Imagine that, God speaking into the future, naming a pagan king, and declaring that this man would rebuild his city and set his people free. Isaiah even records the Lord saying, I will go before you, and I will level the mountains. I will break down gates of bronze and cut through bars of iron for the sake of Jacob my servant and Israel my chosen. Cyrus didn't act out of sympathy. He acted under divine orchestration. He may not have known Israel's God personally, but he was moved by him powerfully. The same hand that wrote judgment on Babylon's wall now wrote mercy into Persia's decree. And just as God once used Pharaoh to display his power, now he used Cyrus to display his providence, showing that kings rise and fall, but every heart still beats at the command of the Lord. Cyrus not only issued the decree, he commanded the people of Babylon to supply the returning exiles with silver, gold, livestock, and provisions, and he himself providing from his own treasury the articles belonging to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem. Then he said, any Jew who wanted to go home could leave. So in 538 BC, the first group of exiles, made up of Judah, Benjamin, and Levites and priests, around 50,000 exiles, gathered to make the journey, led by Zerubbabel and guided by Joshua the priest. Remember King Jehoshaphat of Judah. Though taken captive by Babylon, he was later released by Nebuchadnezzar's son and honored at the king's table. This act preserved the bloodline of Jesus. Matthew 1:12 tells us that Zerubbabel was a direct descendant of Jehoiachin. Can you imagine what the exiles were feeling? I'm sure they were confused, for some, born in the exile, probably didn't even know any better, nor could they yearn for what they did not know or hadn't experienced. Besides, life was comfortable. But there were still remnants from the exiled generation holding on to hope and trusting the Lord to rescue them, to build them into a nation once more in their homeland. And one can hardly believe that not everyone returned. Scholars estimate that several hundred thousand Jews were living in Babylon and the broader Persian Empire by the time of Cyrus's decree. This means that the vast majority, perhaps 80 to 90%, chose to remain in Babylon rather than to return to Jerusalem. Why? Well, after 70 years, many Jews had built homes, businesses, and social networks in Babylon. The idea of uprooting everything to return to a ruined city was daunting. Jerusalem was in ruins. The journey was long and dangerous, and the work ahead, rebuilding the temple, walls, and society, was overwhelming. Some may have lost the urgency of return, having adapted the Babylonian culture and life. The prophetic call to rebuild required faith and sacrifice, which not all were ready to embrace. Yet for those who went, it was more than a relocation. It was a spiritual homecoming. They carried not just supplies, but the promise of restoration, the memory of covenant, and the hope that God was still writing their story. And now our story continues in Ezra chapter 3. In that seventh month of the first year of Cyrus, after the remnants had finally settled in their towns, they assembled together as one in Jerusalem. And there, amid the rubble and silence of a once glorious city, they built again, not a wall, not a palace, but an altar. Before a single stone of the temple was laid, worship was restored. The first priority was to reclaim relationship with Yahweh. They built the altar on its ancient foundation, right where it had stood before, and they offered burnt offerings to the Lord, morning and evening, just as it was written in the law of Moses. But fear still lingered. Enemies surrounded them on every side. But they knew, if the altar stood, hope stood with it. It was their declaration, we are home and our God still reigns. And then they celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles. Nothing was perfect. Nothing looked the same as before. Some didn't even know what it should look like. But it didn't matter. They were celebrating the Almighty. They were enjoying His presence. Soon after, they laid the foundation of the temple. The priests stood in their robes with trumpets, the Levites with cymbals, and together they sang, He is good. His love towards Israel endures forever. The sound of praise rose over the ruins, echoing across the city that once burned. But it was a moment of mixed emotion. As the younger generation shouted with joy, the elders, those who had remembered Solomon's temple, wept aloud. They had seen the glory that once was, and now, standing on broken ground, they felt both sorrow and gratitude. Ezra 3:13 says, the sound of their weeping and rejoicing mingled together so much that no one could distinguish the two. The fire of exile had refined their faith, and now on the sacred foundation, they began to rebuild what only grace could restore. They worked hard, but against incredible odds. Every day was a fight against their enemies and the battlefield of their minds. For though the foundation was laid, the work soon stalled. Fear, opposition, and discouragement crept in. And soon the enemies of the past began to claw their way into their morale. From every direction, opposition began to rise, quiet at first, but then relentless. The Horites, Ammonites, and Arabs, the very people who had once rejoiced over Judah's fall, now stirred up resistance against their return. Their strategy was not always through open war, but through a subtle sabotage. At first, they came with offers that seemed harmless. "Let us build with you," they said, "for we seek your God as you do." But their motives were poisoned. When Zerubbabel and the elders realized what really was going on, they refused their offer. Then the enemy bribed advisors to frustrate their attempts to rebuild. They spread rumors, twisted the truth to discredit them. Then they whispered fear into the hearts of the workers. Fear of failure, fear of futility, fear that perhaps God was no longer with them. And so, brick by brick, progress slowed. The hammers grew silent. Letters were written to the Persian court, accusing the Jews of plotting insurrection. It was a calculated tactic, using bureaucracy to choke the work of God. When the order finally came down from the king's office, construction ground to a halt, and for the next 7 years the temple stood incomplete. The people turned inward, weary and confused. Some returned to their own homes and fields. Others wondered if perhaps the timing was wrong, or if God had withdrawn his favor. But the truth was deeper. This was a spiritual battle, not merely political or physical. The same voice that whispered to Eve in the garden was now whispering to the remnant in Jerusalem. Did God really say you should rebuild? And for a time, they believed it. Folks, there was so much going on in the background. During this time, in the third year of Cyrus, which would probably be 3 years into their return, Daniel received another revelation in Daniel chapter 10 concerning a great war. The understanding came to him in a vision. He was so affected he mourned and fasted for 3 weeks, a whole 21 days. And then, on the 21st day, Daniel lifted his eyes and saw a man unlike any he had ever seen before. His face shone like lightning, his eyes burned like fire, and his voice thundered like a multitude. Strength left Daniel's body, and the angel said something like this to Daniel. "From the very first day you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come because of them. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me for 21 days. For 3 weeks I battled him, until Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. He is your prince, Daniel, the guardian of your people. Know this, what happens on earth is but the shadow of what is already being fought in the heavens. Kings rise, empires fall, but behind them stand powers, spiritual rulers who contend against the purposes of God. But don't worry, Michael stands with me, and the decree of the Lord will not fail. Michael, the archangel, guardian of Israel, stands as God's warrior, heaven's commander in the unseen realm. We see him again in Daniel 12, rising in the time of great distress, a time unlike any since nations first came to be. But even then, deliverance is promised. At that time, your people, everyone whose name is found written in the book, will be delivered. After nearly 2 decades back in the land, 18 years since their return, and 16 since the foundation was first laid, God raised up 2 prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. Both prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, were God's voice to a weary remnant. Their words came not to condemn, but to awaken, to reignite courage when hearts began to falter. Haggai's message cut through apathy like a trumpet blast. He called the people to remember their priorities. "Is it a time for you yourselves to be living in paneled houses while this house remains a ruin?" His words stirred the hearts of Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest. The people trembled before the Lord and returned to the work. Through Haggai, God reminded them, "I am with you," and promised that the latter glory of this house would be greater than the former. Then came Zechariah, the prophet of visions and hope. While Haggai's voice urged them to act, Zechariah's visions lifted their eyes higher to see not just bricks and mortar, but the spiritual restoration God was accomplishing. He saw Joshua the high priest, clothed in filthy garments, accused by Satan, until God himself replaced them with clean robes, symbolizing the cleansing of his people. He saw a golden lampstand and olive trees declaring, "Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts." Through Zechariah, God reminded the remnant that this rebuilding was not merely architectural, it was spiritual. The Lord himself was returning to dwell amongst his people. Together, Haggai and Zechariah revived a nation's faith. One stirred their hands, the other lifted their hearts. So the work began again in the second year of the new king, Darius. Now do not get confused by the name. This Darius is not Darius the Mede, under whom Daniel served in Babylon. That was many years earlier. This Darius, known in history as Darius I, the Great, was the Persian king who ruled after Cyrus. He reigned over a vast empire stretching from India to Egypt, and it was during his second year that the rebuilding of the temple resumed. God moved his heart, just as he had done with Cyrus before him, proving once again that even kings and empires bend to his divine purpose. This King Darius was also stirred by God to fund and support the rebuilding of the temple. He ordered that the work continue without interference, that the builders be supplied daily from the royal treasury, and that anyone who opposed the project would face severe judgment. And through the long months that followed, God's favor rested upon them. No army invaded. No decree halted the work again. The eyes of the enemies watched, but heaven's hand covered the builders. At last, after 20 years of labor and waiting, in the sixth year of King Darius, the temple was completed. When the day came to dedicate the house of God, all the returned exiles gathered in Jerusalem. The priests and Levites took their places. The trumpets were lifted high, and the people rejoiced with one voice. They offered sacrifices in celebration. But this was more than a dedication. It was a homecoming. The same God who had once left the temple in Ezekiel's vision was now returning to dwell amongst his people again. The Passover was celebrated that same spring. The priests purified themselves, the people cleansed their hearts, and once again the lamb was slain, not in Babylon, but in Jerusalem. The exile was over, and so the temple stood once more, rebuilt not by might nor by power, but by the Spirit of the Lord. Joy had returned to Jerusalem, for a while at least, because as we know, God was still writing the story. A plot was forming, not against walls or stones, but against the very people of God. And in the palace of a foreign king, a young Jewish woman would be called to risk everything. Well, folks, we'll have to wait until the next episode to see how it all unfolds. In the meantime, please share these episodes with your friends and family. Let's work together to spread the word of God and reignite a passion for the powerful, often overlooked stories of the Old Testament. Don't forget to like and subscribe to the Epic Podcast on YouTube, a chronological and visual journey through the Old Testament. You can find me under Michelle Neathling 6170, the Epic Podcast. You can also follow me on social media, Facebook, Michelle Neathling Art, Instagram, Michelle Neathling Art. And remember, that's Michelle with just one L. Check out my website, intuitiveprophetic.co.za. If you'd like a beautiful hardcover edition of my book, The Epic, a chronological and visual guide through the Old Testament, you can order directly from me at michellenethlingart@gmail.com. Both books, Crossing the Jordan River and The Epic, are available on Takealot South Africa and soon to be on Amazon internationally.